story was not about the decision, explicitly about the decisions to drop the bomb. That, you know, all of a sudden, whether we should have dropped it or not was had been called into question, you know, across the country and around the world. And the government is scrambling to state, you know, to reclaim the narrative, which is we had to drop the bombs. It saved both American and Japanese lives. And, you know, that's the article, the sort of retort article, is it takes a sort of a page out of the Hersey book of reporting, where it appears to be just sort of a nothing but the facts, ma'am, type article. But it, again, it doesn't ever address radiation in the article. And it doesn't address the fact that so much had been covered up from the American public over the last 18 months.
You know, he went back nearly 40 years later for a follow-up to visit some of the people that he had talked to after the Hiroshima bombing. And they'd all had interesting lives. One of them, Reverend Tanimoto, had become something of an activist. He'd gone around giving speeches and interviews and lectures. One of the most bizarre stories in this book is in 1951, he ends up in Los Angeles for what he thinks will be an interview on NBC TV, a standard interview. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, Reverend Tanimoto turns up at the station, and it turns out he's not doing a news interview. He has been booked unwittingly on an episode of This Is Your Life.
Now, people aren't going to remember this. You have to explain what this show is.
Well, so it's a show, you know, in the 1950s where, you know, you sit down and the producers trot out, you know, people from, well, first, they're trotting out people who have been important to you throughout your life. And so, you know, each person as they're introduced, they stand behind a little curtain and they say, I was, you know, with you when you were 3 years old and you scraped your knee or whatever. You know, and so in this case, they were bringing out people from Reverend Tanimoto's life, including one of the bombers from the Enola Gay. And so, you know, poor Reverend Tanimoto, he's sitting there on this set and, you know, trying to maintain his composure. And it's a very, you know, the set is just full of bells and whistles. You know, they have the sound of, you know, the bomb whirring. They have the sound of the clock ticking. I mean, it's just this highly produced, dramatic production, and you know, this poor Reverend is just sitting there, just totally bewildered, but trying so hard to stay composed. And the moment where they bring out the bomber to shake hands, I mean, it's just, you can't even imagine what's going through that Tanimoto's mind. And Hersey would report on this later on, and he said that the bomber appeared to be crying to many millions of viewers who were watching this, but in reality, Hersey reported, it turned out that he had been out bar hopping beforehand.
Is it too much to say that John Hersey's reporting here changed the world's perception of nuclear weapons?
I certainly don't think so, and he didn't think so either. And he was an extremely modest person when it came to, you know, evaluating his place in the world. Look, the Japanese could not, for years, tell the world what it had been like to be on the receiving end of nuclear warfare because they were under, you know, such dire press restrictions by the occupation forces. And so it took John Hersey's reporting to show the world what the true aftermath and the true experience of nuclear warfare looks like. The Japanese would not be able to tell, you know, speak in their own words until, you know, the occupation was over in the early 1950s. It changed overnight for many people what was described as one of Hersey's contemporaries as the, quote, 4th of July feeling about Hiroshima. I mean, there was a lot of dark humor about, you know, the bombings in Hiroshima. I mean, it just really imbued the event with a sobriety that it really hadn't been there before. Hersey's reporting played an enormous role in creating that visceral feeling around the use of nuclear weapons. And he himself later said, you know, that the thing that has kept the world safe from another nuclear attack since 1945 has been the memory of what happened in Hiroshima. And he certainly created a cornerstone of that memory.
You know, at the end of the book, you share some thoughts about why this story is important, this kind of journalism. Why?
The project for me came from current events, even though it's a historical narrative. And, you know, I'm a second generation news person. I'm married to a news person. My father worked for Walter Cronkite. And, you know, the attacks from the highest levels of our government, you know, especially from our president, on our free press and journalists, and citing journalists as enemies of the people, has felt very personal to me. And I wanted to find a historical narrative that really drove home how deadly important a free press is, not only as a cornerstone of democracy, but in protecting the common good. And John Hersey's story was the sharpest and most poignant example that I could find of that.
Yeah, you know, it's a case where, you know, the government had a certain narrative about what happened at Hiroshima that they wanted to kind of impose. And it would have worked. Reporters were distracted by other things. But here's one case where somebody persisted, got in, found the story, and had a vehicle for communicating it to people. And it just made an enormous difference, didn't it?
And saved potentially millions of lives. I mean, the world did not know the truth about what nuclear warfare really looked like on the receiving end, or did not really understand the full nature of these then experimental weapons until John Hersey got into Hiroshima and reported it to the world.
Well, Leslie Bloom, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Leslie Bloom's new book is Fallout, The Hiroshima Cover-Up and the Reporter Who Revealed It to the World. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Black Bottom Saints, Alice Randall's new novel about a once-thriving African-American neighborhood in Detroit. This is Fresh Air.
At the University of Alaska Southeast, we believe education empowers people. Education provides opportunities and enriches lives, and it needs to be accessible. Dedicated professors inspire and motivate. Experienced advisors guide your path. Choose from dozens of degrees like marine biology, teacher education, and personalized interdisciplinary programs. Enroll now. Fall classes start August 24th. uas.alaska.edu.
Alaska's roadways are full of hazards, but safety for you and your passengers starts inside the vehicle. So look around you and be sure to wear your seatbelt, including the shoulder belt, and wear it correctly. Ensure all child seats and restraints are properly installed. Secure loose objects inside your vehicle, such as pets, equipment, and cargo. Occupant protection is for everyone. Protect yourself and all passengers, and arrive alive. Paid for by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
This is Fresh Air. Alice Randall is a country songwriter and an award-winning novelist, best known for her first novel, The Wind Done Gone, a sort of retelling of Gone with the Wind from the perspective of an enslaved woman. Randall's latest book, Black Bottom Saints, is a historical novel about the Black Bottom neighborhood of Detroit, once a thriving center of black-owned businesses and night spots. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Back in the heyday of Detroit, from the Great Depression through the 1950s, Joseph Ziggy Johnson knew just about everybody who was worth knowing in the shops, bars, churches, theaters, and nightclubs that lined the streets of that city's celebrated black neighborhood called Black Bottom. Johnson was a gossip columnist for the African-American newspaper, the Michigan Chronicle. He also was a legendary nightclub MC at two of the swankiest hotspots in town, the Flame and the Driftwood Lodge. And he founded the Ziggy Johnson School of the Theater to lift up the children of the city's black breadwinners, the workers, most of them men, on the assembly lines of Detroit's automobile plants, which ran 24/7, 7 days a week. As Ziggy tells us in Alice Randall's buoyant and innovative new novel, Black Bottom Saints, this was the economic opportunity that created Caramel Camelot. Ziggy Johnson is just one of the over 50 mostly real-life African-American artists, doctors, sports figures, activists, and behind-the-scenes movers and shakers who populate this novel, many of whom I've never heard of, and most of whom I now want to know more about. I can't think of a more sparkling way to get some education about the history of Black Detroit beyond Motown than to read Randall's novel. As its short chapters whiz by, you get a taste of what it might have been like to have sat in the audience of one of those nightclub shows that Ziggy emceed, where maybe Mom's Mabley was waiting in the wings, while rumors were flying that Dinah Washington, along with her husband, the NFL superstar Dick Night Train Lane, might be stopping by. Except here, Randall is our MC, and not all the featured guests in this novel are headliners. Black Bottom Saints opens in 1968, where Ziggy Johnson lays dying in a room in Kerwood Hospital, a black-owned, black-staffed, historic institution in Detroit. Knowing the end is near, Ziggy decides to set down his memories. It's a conventional enough premise for a novel, and the only time that Randall relies on convention to tell this panoramic story. Consider the Baroque form of this narrative. Like many of us who were raised Catholic back in the day, Ziggy is familiar with Saints' Day books, a kind of devotional manual in which each day of the year is designated a saint's feast day. Ziggy hits upon the idea of structuring his jam-packed memories in the form of a secular Saints' Day book. He squeezes in a calendar's worth of anecdotes about Black Bottom personalities this way. And, as befits a nightclub MC, Ziggy concludes each of his Saints' entries not by recommending food for their feast days, but rather specialty cocktails. In fact, one of the very first Saints Ziggy celebrates is Tom Bullock. Bullock was the first African-American to write a cocktail recipe book, a country club bartender barred from tasting his own drinks. His book, The Ideal Bartender, came out in 1917 and sported an introduction by George Herbert Walker, the maternal grandfather of President George H.W. Bush. Ziggy recalls he first met Bullock at the Plantation Club in St. Louis and tells us, "Every bar I ever walked into was improved by my knowing that every bar in America owes something to one brilliant Sepian, Thomas Bullock." Bullock's feast day cocktail, by the way, is the Blue Blazer, whiskey, sugar, lemon peel, and a match to set the whole concoction aflame. Sepian is a word that Ziggy uses a lot to refer to black people. It's his opinionated, distinctive voice that rescues Black Bottom Saints from being the static series of tweaked Wikipedia entries it might have been. His anecdotes about real-life famous folks, like the Mills Brothers, Bricktop, Butterbeans and Susie, may be, like that Blue Blazer cocktail, part straight whiskey, part flaming invention. But they take readers deep into the world of mid-20th century black entertainers who traveled the country by train, carrying the backdrops, the showgirls, and the main acts with them. And turning away from the spotlight, Ziggy celebrates his reciprocal relationship with the black auto workers who packed his nightclubs. "When I'm driving some other black man's sweat and prosperity, some other black man's competence. And the next week, that man will be sitting in my audience. His approval will matter." Black Bottom Saints is a gorgeous swirl of fiction, history, and motor oil. There are also plenty of cocktail recipes here to make the rougher stories go down a little smoother.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Black Bottom Saints by Alice Randall. On tomorrow's show, Atlantic executive editor Adrian LaFrance explores the conspiracy theory QAnon about a purported cabal of deep state conspirators connected to Democrats who engage in child sex trafficking. QAnon adherents often appear at Trump rallies, and one supporter has won the Republican nomination to a Georgia congressional seat. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, Joel Wolfram, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One. Capital One's banking app lets people manage their money anytime, anywhere. Capital One, this is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org.
In the fight against the coronavirus, we're still facing the same problem we did in March, a shortage of masks and other personal protective equipment. This time, it's not just hospitals, but churches, schools.
Everyone that's trying to reopen needs PPE, and we're all competing for the same small supply.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, sketching the history of the ferry system's first 50 years, Alaska's Marine Highway takes you along the state's 3,500 miles of coast. At 9, Oregon Field Guide tours the North Fork Smith River, traversing a desert canyon in the middle of the rainforest. The Alaska Film Archives rolls footage of the D2 public lands debate at 9:30. Tonight on 360 North and at KTOO.org.
Welcome to Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Cheryl Snyder, and it's Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. On today's show, Cancer Connection shares details of this year's Beat the Odds virtual race. AEYC and CERC will tell us how to earn a Childhood Development Associate certification. And Catholic Community Services will check in with us about their upcoming events and activities. Those conversations, music, and more right here on Juno Afternoon. There are blue skies outside the studio windows right now. It is 61 degrees in Juneau and 57 degrees in Hoonah and Gustavus. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Democratic National Convention Day 2 included a meeting of the Native American Caucus. Speakers talked about the importance of voting in the general election, youth empowerment, and having Native American representation in office. Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota Peggy Flanagan touched on some of the Native issues being addressed in her state, including missing and murdered Indigenous people and tribal-state relationship training. She says it's important to also have allies in office all the way up to the White House who respect treaty rights and tribal sovereignty.
To ensure that we are at the table, that we are being consulted, and that we are no longer taken for granted or simply seen as obstacles, as I would argue that is how we're treated under the Trump administration. There's an incredible opportunity here to ensure that Native people, that our votes are counted, that we turn out. And, you know, for a long time, we talked a lot about Native folks are registering and turning out and impacting elections. And that is true. And we will do it again. But we also know that Native people are stepping up and running for political office in numbers and amounts that we have never seen.
Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke about supporting Indian country issues and working with Congresswoman Deb Haaland on improving health care. Warren urged Native voters to support Joe Biden for president.
As I've said about Joe, he will always tell you where he stands. Well, he has told us where he stands. He stands with Indian country. So Deb and I are continuing our work on our legislation to honor America's promises to the tribal nations. And we're going to keep pushing for a nation-to-nation relationship between tribal nations and the federal government. We will stay in this fight. And with Joe Biden in the White House and a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate, we're going to have an opening unlike any in modern history.
Democrats officially nominated Biden as their nominee for president Tuesday night. The virtual roll call from each state nominating Biden featured four indigenous people from Alaska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and New Mexico. The night also included mentions of indigenous lands in Wisconsin, which is hosting the DNC, and a unique keynote address from 17 leaders across the country, from mayors to state lawmakers and Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez. Nez took to social media Tuesday night talking about his DNC remarks and urging Navajo citizens to vote.
If you don't vote, don't complain. That's the simplest thing I could say, because you have an opportunity to make change happen. You know, I'm not going to be in this position forever. There's going to be somebody behind me, younger leaders that are coming up. You know, this keynote address was given to only 17 people throughout this country. 17 people in the Navajo Nation was represented.
The convention continues Wednesday with caucus meetings. Biden will deliver his acceptance speech on Thursday. The Cherokee Nation welcomed two bison this week from Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming to its herd in northeast Oklahoma. The bison are from a partnership with the Intertribal Buffalo Council. The Cherokee Nation is one of 16 tribes across the country to receive bison from Yellowstone. The tribe's been growing its bison herd the last 5 years, managing a ranch with about 180 bison. The tribe's working on preservation efforts and seeking economic opportunities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Vision Maker Media's first Indigenous online film festival, an online 5-week-long celebration of American Indian, Alaska Native, and worldwide Indigenous films from August 31st to October 5th at visionmakermedia.org.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Programming support comes from listeners like you and from the Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with 6 cafes and drive-thru locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com. Support comes from Alaska 529. Experiences that spark a child's curiosity and imagination can lead to big things, and Alaska 529 works to help families plan for it. More at alaska529plan.com. Save in Alaska. Study anywhere.
This is KTOO's Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Cheryl Snyder. KTOO Public Media would like to acknowledge the Tlene Di and the Wushkitan of the Akwan. We are on their ancestral homeland. Our broadcast studios are built on fill that was once tideland and part of what is called the Indian Village. We recognize those families who have never relinquished their hunting and fishing rights, nor their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways. The families of the Juneau Indian Village, like their ancestors, cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront. KTOO is working to lift up Tlingit voices and the Tlingit language. Please excuse us for our mistakes and gunoshtish for your patience as we learn. This is Juneau Afternoon. My first guest on the show today is Blue Shibler from AEYC, here to talk to us about the Early Childhood Academy. Blue, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Cheryl.
Well, it's terrific to hear your voice on the line. Let's start, Blue, by having you share about the work of AEYC. What do you do?
Sure. Well, AORC is a nonprofit organization that supports and promotes high-quality learning for children birth through eight. And we do that by supporting everybody who cares for, educates, and works on behalf of young children in Southeast Alaska.
Okay. And the upcoming academy is in partnership with CERC. Can you share how your two organizations have come together on early childhood education?
Yeah, so it's actually a four-way partnership. It's AUIC and Thread Services, where I work, and then it's CERC, Southeast Regional Resource Center, and their JobX program. And then we also are partnering with the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida and their child care program supports, and also CBJ. So it's a four-way equal partnership. And, you know, on CERC's end, they have this JobX program, and where one of the focuses is partnering and pairing youth and businesses together to help develop and manage opportunities to build work skills through paid work experiences. So they work with youth who might have some barriers to finding a job, like through normal avenues, and they connect those people with businesses who are looking for a workforce.
Okay.
So child care is a really good fit for that, because child care is looking for a workforce, always, kind of, and internships are a really great thing to do to get child care workers in.
Mm-hmm. And is this the first time that this group of four organizations has partnered on the Early Childhood Academy?
Yes, this is our pilot program. We hope to host it once or twice a year if it's successful and interest continues. But this will be our first intern program to get people trained.
And how long have you been planning and working to make this happen?
Well, since the beginning of the summer, I think it's been being talked about. That was before I was even an AYC employee. But really, in the big picture, we've been talking about this for years, because there's it's really hard to find a workforce in childcare, and part of that is because there's not a lot of training opportunities in town.
Mm-hmm. And so, can you speak to the why now? What sort of things have come together to make it possible to do this now?
Well, it's just the collaboration of these four organizations and the financial resources that they're providing.
Okay, terrific. Well, let's talk about what the Academy is. How can you describe the curriculum for us?
Okay, well, so the curriculum is based on a national program called the Child Development Associate, and that's a nationally recognized credential. It's a very widely recognized credential in the field, and it's considered a key stepping stone on the path of career advancement in early learning and child care field. And the CDA credential is based on a core set of competency standards that guide early care professionals as they work toward becoming qualified teachers of young children. So there's all these different areas that the interns will learn about, including basics of brain development, making meaningful connections, interactions and relationships, guidance at work, the value of play, parent, family, and community engagement, and ethics and professionalism, health and safety requirements, just all the basics.
Okay, and what are you looking for in candidates for the program?
Well, we're looking ideally for youth ages 18 to 24 that have a GED or high school diploma. We want them to make a commitment to working in the early childhood field for a year, and just really be committed to learning and growing and advancing their skills and knowledge in the early care and education field.
Okay, and what kind of financial commitment is required of those who want to do this program?
There's no financial commitment required. It is a paid internship. So the internship, the training part of it, like the in-classroom training part of it, is 8 weeks long, where interns will be in a learning environment, learning, working toward their CDA credential. for half of the day, and then the other half of the day they'll actually go to a child care program and work in a classroom and sort of apply all of the knowledge that they gained in their learning environment. So that goes on for about 8 weeks, and then there's an additional a few hundred hours paid where they work full-time in the child care program that they've been interning at. And so it's a complete paid internship. And then at the end of the eight-week training intensive, there's also a $2,000 graduation bonus. So there's no financial commitment required, but they will receive basically a wage.
Well,
for attending.
That's terrific. I'm sure that'll be attractive to many young folks looking for some opportunities this fall. I know I heard you say that you based the program on a national program that was likely developed before there was a pandemic. How are you making modifications to accommodate the fact that there aren't, you know, some daycares might not be open or at the time that students need to be doing their sort of practical in daycare sessions?
Yeah, well, we'll have a mitigation plan in place that all of the participants have to follow. Then they also have to agree to follow the mitigation plan of any center that chooses to host them. All of the child care centers in town right now are open at some capacity and some level, and they've all agreed to host an intern because they recognize the value in that they're going to be possibly getting, a certified employee out of the deal. Mm-hmm. So, other than like mitigation planning and just being really careful and aware of how this virus impacts large group childcare, that's about it.
Okay. And how many students do you have capacity for? How many interns?
We're looking for 6 interns this time around.
Okay. And for those that are interested, how do they get in touch with you to get their application in?
Okay, so they can either call AUIC at 789-1235, or they can email info@aeyc-sea.org, and they can request an application that way, either way. And they can also, anybody that's interested can email that address and ask for a Zoom link. I'll be hosting an information evening tonight via Zoom at 6 p.m. So people can Zoom in to the meeting and ask any questions that they want, and I'll be able to answer them. And then at that time, they can also request an application.
Okay, terrific. Blue, is there anything else you wanted to share today about the upcoming Academy?
Just really hoping to get the word out there. I don't know how many 18 to 24-year-olds listen to public radio, but if you're out there listening and you have youth in your lives who you think this would be good for, please send them our way.
And maybe for our audience who knows some 18 to 34-year-olds who could possibly be interested, they can get in touch with you as well.
Yeah, they could.
Okay, Blue Shibler of AEYC, thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for sharing about the Early Childhood Academy.
Thanks for having me, Cheryl.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hey, Brian.
Up in the morning and out to school, the teachers are teaching the golden rule, American history and practical math. Studied so hard and hoping to pass, working your fingers right down to the bone, and the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell, I took my mom too ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat.
is their body and soul.
Salt and Soil Marketplace is open for its fourth year as Juneau's online farmer's market. If you are a backyard gardener, forager, or commercial farmer or fisherman, you can use Salt and Soil to sell your product online. If you are a customer, your purchase strengthens Southeast local food economy by supporting your fellow Alaskans and their livelihoods. The marketplace offers weekly local pickup or delivery on Saturdays. Sign up and find out more at www.saltandsoilmarketplace.com, a program of the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition.
As Juneau's economy begins to reopen, it's important for older adults and anyone with an underlying medical condition to reduce their risk of being exposed to COVID-19. Stay home as much as possible. Ask others to do errands for you or have items delivered. If you feel ill, contact your healthcare provider for testing or call Juneau's COVID-19 screening hotline at 586-6000, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. daily. Learn more at juneau.org.
This is KTOO's Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Cheryl Snyder. Joining me now on the program are Emily Ricci and Kim Mosseth from Cancer Connection, who are here to tell us about this year's Beat the Odds race. Hello, Emily, and hello, Kim.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi. Well, Emily, let's start with you. Can you tell us about all the work that Cancer Connection does around Southeast Alaska?
Yeah. So my name is Emily Ricci and Cancer Connection. I'm on the board of Cancer Connection, and Cancer Connection is a local nonprofit, a grassroots nonprofit based right here in Juneau. And our mission is really to help support cancer survivors and their families across Southeast Alaska. So we have a couple of different programs that we do to achieve that. We have monthly survivorship groups where people can come together and talk with other people who may be dealing with similar issues. We also have a Let's Talk program where we'll connect someone who's been diagnosed with another individual that may have a similar diagnosis or circumstance, so they can really ask questions that are fairly specific and unique to their specific situation. And then we have a apartment in Seattle with subsidized rent available for individuals who need to get treatment down there. And we also have a travel reimbursement program as well for travel costs for people that need to travel. So really a lot of different ways we try to support the community here in Juneau and across Southeast Alaska.
Mm-hmm. And about how many individuals make use of these services each year?
Oh, hundreds each year, I would say, with the various services. And we really, we get people contacting us from communities across Alaska, you know, Wrangell, Petersburg, Haines, whether they're traveling to Juneau for treatment here. Radiation oncology now is provided in town and has been for a couple of years. So we see people traveling here for that, or whether they're traveling down to Seattle as well.
How has COVID impacted or changed the way that you provide services to individuals?
Oh, COVID, you know, getting a cancer diagnosis is devastating. And that is just an intense, scary, ever-shifting experience. And then to add COVID on top of that, particularly if you're just beginning treatment or in the middle of treatment, I always like to say that COVID makes every decision challenging because there's now risk involved in almost any interaction. And when that risk involves someone who may have a weakened immune system, there's so many things to consider. So we initially saw a drop in people utilizing some of the apartment and the travel reimbursement programs, but we're starting to see that pick up again. And we've moved online for our survivorship meetings. So we just had our last one this month on Tuesday, but we have survivorship meetings. They're offered over Zoom. I've facilitated a couple of them, and it's pretty fun. So they are the third Tuesday of every month. And if you think that that's something that you would benefit from, you could just reach out to Cancer Connection and we will send you a link to those meetings.
How has the Zoom meetings impacted the participation level at those meetings?
To be honest, we've mostly gotten ladies. And I know that there are a lot of men that would benefit from these meetings as well. So we'd encourage everyone to participate in these.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing about all the services of Cancer Connection. You have a big fundraiser coming up. I imagine this provides an important portion of the funds needed to do the work that you do. Beat the Odds race. This is something that's been in existence for a few decades at least. What can you tell us about how this year's event is going to go? Kim, do you want to take that one?
This is Kim. I'm also a board member with Cancer Connection. This year is the 29th annual Beat the Odds, a race against cancer. And this year will be virtually. People can come anytime during the day starting Saturday, August 22nd, through the following Saturday, August 29th. We will have two courses available, a 2-mile walk and a 5K race that will receive NAO Cup points for any runners out in the community. The course will be marked. We encourage people to acknowledge social distancing rules that we have in place in the community. We encourage people to register online at our Cancer Connection website. We have t-shirts available for the first 300 registrants, and we started distributing those t-shirts this week. And anyone that is looking to pick up a t-shirt so that they can wear during their walk or race, they can pick it up between noon and 2 this week at the Cancer Connection office.
Okay, great. So participants have a full week to do whatever they're going to do, either walk or run a 2-mile walk or a 5K race. They register online, but then once they've done their thing, once they've walked or run, how do they log that with you?
So the walkers don't need to log their time with us. They just go out and run at, or walk at their leisure. We're not going to monitor if they've actually walked or not. That's fine. The runners, however, need to submit their times via a link on the Cancer Connection website. That way they can still get their points. And everybody that's registered will be eligible for some fabulous door prizes that we have. And we'll be drawing names for that after the event ends. So sometime after the 29th, and winners will be contacted via email or phone, and we'll also put a list of winners out on the Cancer Connection website.
Okay, terrific. Now, the registration fee, that's the fundraising portion for you, at least a piece of that. How much are you hoping to raise this year in the event?
Well, that's a good question. The fee for adults this year is $25 and $20 for youth, which is kind of on par with what we've done in the past. And so far with our pre-registrations, we're really happy with the numbers that we're seeing. We, like I said, only are guaranteeing shirts for the first 300 registrants, but we still have shirts available. Some people have chosen not to have shirts, but we still have enough shirts available. And I just encourage those of you that want one of our lovely teal t-shirts this year to get online and register so that, and come in and pick up your t-shirt as well, so that you have a better chance of getting the size that you want.
Okay, terrific. Have we missed any details about the event you think participants need to know?
Well, probably.
Well, where can interested people go to get more information?
At the Cancer Connection website. But I guess I should mention that the course is pretty similar to recent years. So we start at the Riverbend School covered playground, and the course will be marked with chalk and with signs out there. And so people can come out anytime, starting Saturday morning on August 22nd. And our website is cancerconnectionak.org.
Okay. Emily, anything more that you wanted to share?
I would just add that if you have any questions, I know, you know, some people may not be as comfortable with the internet as others. You can also give us a call at 907-796-2273. So that's 907-796-2273.
Okay, well, I commend your organization for getting so creative on how to pull this race off this year. I know it's an important one for many to be involved with, and of course, really important for your organization to raise the funds to support those who have cancer and their families. So thank you both for being on the program today, Emily Ricci and Kim Mosseth from Cancer Connection. Good luck with this year's Beat the Odds race.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
You are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm your host today, Cheryl Snyder. Joining me now on the call today is Jana Auger, the volunteer coordinator for Catholic Community Services. Welcome, Jana. Thanks for being on the program.
Yes, thank you.
So can you share about the work of Catholic Community Services? Why don't we start there?
Well, I'm specifically working with a new program for Catholic Community Services that called Friends of Seniors. And this is a volunteer program where we link volunteers with adults over 60.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit more about how that works.
Yeah, so this is a new program for Catholic Community Services, a new program in Juneau. And we are able to offer this. We've recently gotten a grant from Community Care Corps, who provided grants nationwide, and we were one of the few grantees that were offered this funding to provide
they funded volunteer programs for non-medical services. So the program that we're offering, that we're providing, is specifically designed to help seniors remain independent in their homes, as well as to alleviate barriers between asking for and receiving help.
Okay, terrific. Go ahead, continue, Jenna.
So the program is really, we link volunteers with the seniors that, and then the volunteers that we're looking for are really, I mean, our vision for the program is a network across Juneau, in every neighborhood in Juneau, where we have a volunteer so that we can call them up and say, you know, Jane Doe down the road, we could really use somebody stopping by once a week to, you know, bring wood pellets into her home. So it's these really simple tasks. We have a list of about 13 service categories that we'll be offering. And we're looking for volunteers who can come in and do these. Some of these real simple tasks, some of them are non-contact tasks. So things that people can do without, that feel comfortable really sort of not being in homes right now. And then we have other service categories where there's a deeper level of help, where we're really going in to homes and maybe doing light housekeeping, companionship visits, different things, delivering groceries, different things like that as well. So the program is really diverse. The volunteers that we're looking for, also we're looking for them to be as diverse as our community of Juneau. So to us, that looks like, you know, anybody from a university student through, you know, we're looking for parents and business owners to volunteer. And we're also looking for seniors themselves. I mean, we fully expect that a senior would at one point be a volunteer and then cycle through at different times of ability to be a participant as well. Say during a knee surgery, for instance, maybe needing more help during that time, having somebody come in and provide some, you know, in-home help, and then later sort of being a volunteer themselves. And that reciprocity, that sort of cycling through, is the heart of this program. And it's the heart of Juneau as well. I mean, that's part of our community culture. So we're really wanting to build on those community ties that we know are part of our community and make them deeper. And this program goes long, sort of it's seeded long before the pandemic. It's just where we are with the isolation of this pandemic, it's just heightened the need. We sort of see that need. And we all know what the risks, the health, like physical risks, as well as the emotional risks of isolation are. And our seniors, we've known that for our seniors for a long time. So we really want to help alleviate some of that stress.
Do you already have identified all of the seniors who will be benefiting from these community volunteers?
No. So what our goal is, sort of stage in development, is to really build that volunteer base. And then as we build that volunteer base, we'll be starting to reach out to different areas, different organizations, as well as individuals in the community. So we fully expect that our referral sources will be medical clinics and some of the sort of organizations. Obviously, CCS has a large base. Our senior centers are the bridge, a lot of sort of resources within our organization itself. But we get calls often from adult children down south or up north that aren't local, asking, can somebody just stop by in the morning and help my mother? Can just a check-in visit? Like, we get these kind of calls and know there's a gap in the community. So we fully expect that we get individuals coming in to make requests as well. And that's our goal, is to really sort of be available for anyone in the community over the age of 16.
So you describe this as a new program for Juneau. Is it based off of a successful model you've seen in action in another town, another community?
So this, our model is really unique to what we're seeing the gaps are in our community. As we were sort of seeding the program and envisioning it, we did look at quite a few other volunteer programs. I looked at quite a few other programs, mostly down south, as well as sort of AARP has some really interesting sort of volunteer program as well. So we have been informed by those, but this program, you'll see, like from our list, it really is addressing our community. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you just gave the one example of a volunteer could get involved and help with, you know, delivering wood to a senior. But what do you think is some of the greatest needs you're seeing of our seniors right now?
Greatest need is to address companionship and isolation. I mean, that's a huge question, but that this program can help with is really that piece. How that's done at this time is very varied, and we expect to be able to link into that in different ways. One of our service categories is a tech teaching category. So we'll have iPads we'll be able to bring into homes and set seniors up so they can Zoom to be a part of maybe a music organization that they were previously, and now they're not able to sort of continue that. Or with adult children and family that are outside of the community, and be able to communicate that way. And then for those who have devices in their home, to develop a better comfort level with using those devices during this time. So there's a tech piece. I mean, we're also looking at, we can come in and do sort of food prep and create freezer meals over a long period of time and these kinds of things. I mean, nutrition obviously is a really great way of connecting with people through food. So there's a connection, there's a health benefit, there's all kinds of sort of emotional pieces to that. Mm-hmm. We have a service where we like to really recruit volunteers wanting to proxy fish and hunt for seniors, or even go out with and fish and hunt with people that are not perhaps as comfortable doing that alone anymore, and keeping those cultural traditions and keeping some of the real meaningful parts of our lives intact. Mm-hmm. So that's part of our goals. We have really diverse ways in which we're rolling this out.
Yeah, Jana, as you were talking, I was just thinking about that need for connection. It really goes two way. There's so many people in town who are feeling disconnected and feeling lonely, and the seniors will get just as much out of this as those who are volunteering their time to do this work.
We already hear that. I mean, my volunteers, the few that we have already, they'll be the first to tell you that they're getting as much, if not more, than the recipients themselves, the participants. It goes both ways. And I think now more than ever, how we support each other, how we belong to each other, makes a big difference in how resilient our community and us as individuals can really sort of grow and expand and sort of be resilient. So I think that is part of this program. And like I said, that's part of this program now, but we expect this program to be to evolve beyond a pandemic. It was always our intention to have it evolve beyond the pandemic. Those core values are still part of the program regardless.
Yeah. Terrific. Jana, I'm going to pause with you for a moment. Erin Walker-Tolles has joined the conversation. She is the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services. Welcome, Erin. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me well?
We can hear you perfectly. Erin, can you share sort of broadly, we've been having a terrific conversation about this new volunteer program that you're starting up, but maybe you could talk just generally about the work of Catholic Community Services and how that has had to shift a bit during the pandemic.
Yeah, shift is probably an understatement. Like all nonprofits that are trying to serve people during this time, we had to adapt. Of course, congregate programs for seniors were closed by the state. We actually closed before the state asked us to, because we saw that it wasn't safe for seniors to be congregating. One of the things we really saw is that we saw a huge growth in the number of seniors we were serving during this time. Our Meals on Wheels, almost doubled here in Juneau. We're serving seniors that we hadn't served before. And it's the same at nine of our other senior centers across Southeast. We've seen a huge growth in Meals on Wheels. We've seen a surge in volunteerism and help from the community, civic organizations calling us to say, how can we help? We see that you're doing good work. Let us be helping you either with people or with funding. We've had so many great donations from organizations, tribal organizations and civic organizations. One of our concerns was, of course, we've been making phone calls to seniors, but we're really hoping that we continue. This Friends of Seniors program will help get more person-to-person relationship stuff going. We get a lot of calls about, when are you going to open the senior centers? And we're in the process of evaluating how to do that safely. The state hasn't given a lot of guidance. They've said you can open if you want to, but that's pretty much it. So we're looking at each individual senior center. We did a walkthrough of the Juno Senior Center a couple weeks ago and said, what would it look like? How many staff? What precautions and safety for social distancing? What would we need to make that happen? And of course, we also have to look at the individual community. Right now, Juno is at moderate. I wouldn't open a senior center for vulnerable seniors with moderate and a spike happening. So we'll look at each individual center for procedures and safety materials we need, the community status, and talk to our partners, tribal partners, community partners, and most of all the seniors. How do you want to come back? In Wrangell, they're clamoring, like, when do we get to come back? In other communities, they're like, we're fine, we'll wait. So it really depends on the community, and it's all about safety and responsiveness and planning. And we are in that process to evaluate. Some centers might not reopen because we just, it just won't happen just logistically, physically, the layout, or we don't have enough staff. In Skagway, we've got like 2 employees. We need way more than that to open in Skagway. But we are looking at it, and we want to share those plans with the community when we're ready. I also want to say, do a shout out to the community for thank you so much, and thank you, Glacier Valley Rotary, for helping us. When this happened, our Safe Child Advocacy Center saw a huge drop in the number of kids referred for suspected abuse. We help those kids. We talk to them. They disclose abuse. We help them on the road to healing. We work with other community partners through a multidisciplinary team to get the family help, get them safe, get the kids safe and healing again from that trauma. We saw a huge drop. Kids were isolated. We were all isolated. So we did a public education campaign starting at the beginning of the summer, asking people to look, listen, report, reach out to kids you know. How are they doing? Are they okay? Do they seem off? And whether it is just that we've opened up more or that this public education campaign has helped, we had more kids come to the Safe Child Advocacy Center in July than any other July in the program's history of 20 years. So we feel so relieved that the community is rallying and identifying children who are experiencing abuse, getting them to reporting that to OCS or law enforcement appropriately, and that those kids are coming to us to get the help and the healing started. So thanks to the community, to Glacier Valley Rotary for your support, because we saw all of a sudden, it was like someone flipped a switch and the kids are getting identified, and thank God, because we were all very, very concerned. And of course, this whole time, hospice and home care of Juno has just been chugging along, providing the same great services in the community, on the ground, in people's homes this whole time. I'm so proud of the people I work with and so grateful to the community for all the support and care, because people have rallied and it's making a difference, because honestly, we're serving more people than ever.
Yeah, and let's just jump back for a second about your look, listen, reporting campaign.
Yeah.
And, you know, we should probably emphasize that so long as the normal avenues of connecting with children are disrupted, kids are not starting out the school year in the classroom. That's going to be virtual. Daycares, we just heard in our last interview, are operating at half capacity. So just the ongoing importance of community members just really showing up for each other. And if they see something that's off, it's better to investigate that than let it be and have a child at risk.
Yeah, so, you know, kids don't have the same access to those safe adults, those teachers and coaches and neighbors that they did before. And kids are often scared to say something. They're scared to disclose. But sometimes if you start to ask and you start to notice, they will give you that clue. They'll give you that hint. And that's when you can do the report. Better to report than to not, because we want that trauma to stop and the healing to begin. And we want justice to happen for that family as well. And we stick with them through the whole process. We have some families we've worked with for 4 or 5 years as they go through the prosecution of the perpetrator, and we're with them through the whole thing. It's really all about the community coming together to support safe and healthy kids and families.
Yep. So Catholic Community Services, you have your hands in lots of different areas of our community and all phases of life, from supporting children all the way through the seniors. We started out the conversation with you today talking about the new volunteer program, connecting individuals in town who want to volunteer their time to help out seniors who may have any sort of range of needs, from helping with grocery shopping to things in the house to just companionship. Is that program only happening in Juneau, or are you also setting up chapters of that throughout Southeast?
We're starting in Juneau, and then, you know, based on the success, you know, of course, we get excited, we get enthusiastic about these things. Jana, do you want to pile on that one?
Yeah, we're starting in Juneau, and we have every intention of sort of growing it, not just for this year, but also throughout Southeast. So we would love to see it in different communities. But this is our pilot, and we'd like to see a lot of volunteers really willing to create this network that we've envisioned.
Terrific. So, yeah. So for those who would like to get involved, how do they get a hold of you?
So two ways. You can call us. You can call at 500-3934, or you can apply actually on our website at ccsak.org. And it's .org, not .com, so ccsak.org.
Okay. Erin and Jana, have we left anything out of the conversation today? Anything more you'd like to share with Juneau this afternoon?
Oh, gosh. I could talk all day, but yeah, we're thank you so much for the opportunity. We appreciate joining you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very grateful. Thank you.
Okay. Erin Walker-Tolles, Executive Director of Catholic Community Services, and Jana Auger, Volunteer Coordinator. Thank you to both of you for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Take care.
There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy.
All you need is love. All you need is love. All you need is love. Love.
Love is all you need.
All you need is love. All
Ricky's Bird Note. Do you like to guess the bird before we identify it? Then here's a short quiz for you. Okay, here we go. Bird 1. Yes, that's the song of the American robin. Bird 2. The olive-sided flycatcher. In a few weeks, these flycatchers will leave for their wintering grounds in South and Central America. All right, here comes bird 3. Yup, that's the cry of a red-tailed hawk soaring overhead. How about this one? Did you answer blue jay? Nope. This is the Steller's jay. If you're west of the Rocky Mountains, you're most likely to hear the Steller's jay. East of the Rockies, you'll hear the blue jay. So, how'd you do? Let's run through them again. American robin. Olive-sided flycatcher. Red-tailed hawk. Steller's jay and blue jay. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note comes from American Bird Conservancy and Bringing Back the Birds, a photo book by Owen Deutsch on the importance of protecting birdscapes. Available at Amazon.com.
That's going to close out another edition of Juno Afternoon. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. To listen to individual interviews, see links to the events we discussed, or to be on the show yourself, check out our website at kto.org/JunoAfternoon. Tune in to tomorrow's program to hear Growing Up Black in Juno. This is produced in partnership with the Juno Black Awareness Association. Christina Michelle will host a conversation with three other millennials who all went to school here. Juno Afternoon is produced by Shelley Delaney, and the program is a product of the KTOO Arts Department, which is made up of Shelley, Scott Burton, and myself, Cheryl Snyder. Thanks for hanging out with us today. We'll see you back here tomorrow for Thursday's edition of Juno Afternoon.
Downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org.
Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
If we entrust this nation to Joe, he will do for your family what he did for ours.
Joe Biden officially wins the Democratic nomination. Tonight, his running mate, Kamala Harris, headlines the DNC.
It's Wednesday, August 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Coming up, doctors say flu season plus coronavirus is a potentially lethal mix, so get your flu shot.
People are afraid to go and get vaccinated because they don't want to go back into their doctor's offices.
Also, the federal government is in charge of allocating remdesivir, one of few COVID-19 treatment options.
NPR found some states aren't getting enough.
I don't know that we can say they're doing a good job.